Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Imagine walking into a courtroom, not just with the usual figures of justice, judge, jury, defendant, but one encircled by a vocal army of protesters, bathed in the glare of national media attention and ablaze with a digital firestorm of blogs, Reddit threads, and relentless hashtags. This is the arena where Judge Beverly Cannone now presides over the second trial of Karen Reed. More than just a high-profile case, this has morphed into a pressure cooker, with Judge Cannone squarely in the center of that. Whether by choice or circumstance, she has become a lightning rod. One of the most polarizing figures in what has become a landmark murder trial in Massachusetts history. The crux of the public conversation isn't just about the person beneath the robe, but the way she is wielding the gavel. We're going to break down some of those criticisms today. Let you decide, right or wrong. But let's just address them. Let's throw them out there. What are people talking about and why? And have a educated dialogue rather than just screaming names out and words and you're horrible, it's a lie, it's conspiracy. Okay, let's hear your arguments. Let's talk. Want to hear your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or wherever you're downloading podcasts. Be sure to press subscribe right now so you don't miss any of our coverage on any of this case or the many that we cover for you right here at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. My name's Tony Bruschi, by the way. Hi, nice to meet you. If you're new, welcome. Again, comment as we go along here because I'd love to hear you. So consider one of the most contentious rulings, igniting debate, both inside and outside the courtroom. The decision to prevent the defense from naming Colin Elbert as an alternative suspect in the death of Boston police officer John O'Keefe. Now, to some, this feels like crazy. How could they not allow that? To others, it seems like obviously clear why. Two very different perspectives, though. The defense has consistently maintained that Karen Reed did not fatally strike her boyfriend with her SUV in a drunken accident. Instead, they contend he was assaulted inside a house, left in the snow, and subsequently framed. This theory hinges on the presence of several individuals within the home of Brian Elbert on the night of O'Keefe's death. The defense had previously implicated Brian Elbert himself, his nephew, Colin Elbert, and Brian Higgins, another law enforcement officer. However, for the retrial, Judge Cannone drew a line, specifically excluding Colin Elbert. Her rationale, while perhaps not satisfying to Reed supporters, was that the evidence against Colin Elbert remained unchanged since the first trial. She deemed it insufficient to establish motive, opportunity, or intent, and argued that presenting it to a new jury would be more inflammatory than informative. In a legal term, she found that it did not meet the necessary standard for a third-party culprit defense. Simply put, she was unwilling to allow the defense to name individuals without substantial proof, which is what judges do when there isn't substantial proof. And I don't think you're going to find any judge anywhere who would allow him in as a third-party culprit. There's little to no evidence that shows he had anything to do with this. He just ended up being a young college kid who got harassed, made his life go upside down, affected his education by a group of people that were set off to believe a theory that, again, doesn't have a whole lot of solid backing to it. Looks weird. It looks creepy. Could there be some sort of conspiracy going on here? Not that I think anyone murdered John O'Keefe in the house. Could there be some evidence that's shown that shows a lot of police officers really wanted to arrest Karen Reed and really stick it to her? Yeah, I think you got that. Which is why I believe she was overcharged. But again, while this might seem like a straightforward application of legal principles in a trial where public opinion has become a significant factor, to put it lightly, the decision landed like a shockwave. Colin Albert had been a central figure in the online Free Karen Reed movement. He had been the subject of memes, intense analysis, and numerous accusations across blogs and social media platforms. Therefore, when Judge Cannone officially declared that his name would not be mentioned in court as an alternative suspect, the reaction was far from subdued. Protesters took to the streets with their signs and their pink shirts and all that. Online investigators intensified their efforts, and a chorus of voices insisted that this was not a legal judgment. It was an act of concealment. Judge Cannone, however, appeared unfazed. In fact, she reinforced her position. Her order clarified that Brian Albert and Brian Higgins could still be discussed by the defense, albeit with significant limitations. She noticed that the defense's arguments regarding them barely met the required threshold. Furthermore, she imposed a crucial restriction. The defense was prohibited from naming any of these alleged third-party culprits during their opening statements. She cautioned that such premature accusations could unfairly prejudice the jury before any actual evidence was presented. Regardless of one's opinion on this matter, it clearly illustrates Judge Cannone's firm control over the proceedings. Another ruling that subtly yet significantly impacted the defense's strategy was Judge Cannone's decision to limit the testimony of former FBI agent Michael Easter. The defense had engaged Easter to critique the police investigation into O'Keefe's death. His conclusion was that the investigation was deeply flawed and failed to meet law enforcement standards. However, Judge Cannone ruled that Easter would not be permitted to deliver this broad critique to the jury. Her reasoning was that jurors are fully capable of assessing police conduct themselves, particularly after hearing direct testimony and undergoing cross-examination of the officers involved, allowing an expert to essentially tell them how to interpret the evidence, she argued, was unnecessary. In essence, Judge Cannone determined that the jury did not require a professional guide to navigate the complexities of the investigation. They could reach their own conclusions. This stance is not uncommon in legal proceedings. Judges frequently restrict what is known as ultimate issue testimony, expert opinions that come too close to dictating the verdict. However, from the perspective of Karen Reed's defense, this was not merely a procedural matter. It represented another obstacle in their efforts to demonstrate that the police and the prosecutors had mishandled the case, or worse, were covering up the involvement of someone else. Adding to the challenges faced by the defense was the courtroom drama surrounding attorney Mark Bedrow. A prominent lawyer and former prosecutor from New York, Bedrow had a significant connection to the case. He also represented Aidan Kearney, otherwise known as Turtle Boy, in several related criminal matters. For those unfamiliar, that blogger is the most vocal public advocate for Karen Reed and the driving force behind the Canton cover-up theory. His coverage on the case has been extensive, emotionally charged to say the least, and often directly critical of figures like Judge Cannone. The defense sought to include Bedrow on their team, but Judge Cannone denied their request. Her explanation centered on a conflict of interest. By representing both Reed and Kearney, Bedrow would potentially have access to confidential information from one client that could either benefit or harm the other. His promise or not to use such information was deemed insufficient by the court. The fundamental principle is that a lawyer must maintain undivided loyalty to each client rather than navigating conflicting objections and withholding information from themselves. Despite both Reed and Kearney signing waivers indicating their consent, Judge Cannone maintained the conflict was too significant to overlook. More importantly, she suggested that allowing Bedro's involvement could potentially compromise the entire trial at a later stage. This was not simply a technicality. It blocked a path that the defense clearly considered important. Yet, Judge Cannone remained firm. She pointed out that Reed already had a complete legal team, including multiple out-of-state attorneys who had been approved to participate in the case. She viewed Bedro not as an essential addition, but as a potential risk. The establishment of a buffer zone around the courthouse further intensified the already heated atmosphere following the first trial, which ended in a hung jury. Reports surfaced indicating that protesters, Reed's supporters, who regularly chanted and displayed signs outside of the courthouse, could be heard from within the building. This was even confirmed by a juror. Consequently, as the second trial approached, Judge Cannone issued an order establishing a 200-foot buffer zone around the courthouse. Within this zone, all forms of protest, including signs and clothing with slogans, were prohibited. This perimeter even encompassed the local library situated across the street. I'm sure everybody that just wanted to go get a book loves that. For Judge Cannone, the primary concern was safeguarding the jury from external influences. The notion of jurors walking past a throng of protesters chanting "Free Karen Reed" before entering the courtroom was deemed a little problematic. She emphasized that this was not an attempt to silence anyone's opinions, but rather a measure to protect the integrity of the judicial process. However, Reed supporters perceived this as a suppression of their right to protest. Civil liberty organizations voiced their objections, and a federal lawsuit was filed by local residents who argued that their First Amendment rights were being violated. Once again, Judge Cannone became the target of public condemnation for being the grown-up in the room. Nevertheless, Judge Cannone appeared unmoved by the public outcry, consistent with her previous rulings. Her explanation was rooted in legal principles. She clarified that she was not entirely banning protesters, but merely restricting them with a specific distance from the courthouse to mitigate the potential of juror bias. This is normal. This is common. Just because it doesn't, you don't agree with it or it doesn't feed to what you want to do, doesn't make it wrong. The timing of this order was also significant. A new trial is about to commence, a new jury pool being selected, and Judge Cannone clearly wanted to avoid another round of arguments regarding the potential influence of protesters on the outcome. And another layer to the complexities is the imposition of the gag order. As media coverage of the case has exploded, the members of the defense team gave interviews hinting at evidence still under seal. Judge Cannone intervened. She issued an order prohibiting both the prosecution and the defense from making public statements that could potentially prejudice the case. It's not entirely unexpected, as prosecutors had been requesting such an order, arguing that the defense was leaking grand jury materials and appearing to the public, documentaries and interviews. Judge Cannone had initially hesitated, but as the trial date approached and national news programs like Dateline began covering the story, she implemented the gag order. From that point forward, both sides were restricted in what they could publicly say about anything that might influence potential jurors. Judge Cannone did not take this decision lightly. When defense attorney David Yannetti inadvertently disclosed sealed information during a press interview, Judge Cannone chose not to impose sanctions, accepting that it was an honest mistake. However, the underlying message was clear. This trial would proceed within a controlled environment, or at least as controlled as possible in an era of live stream and widespread online coverage. Even Judge Cannone's demeanor from the bench conveyed a sense of unwavering authority. She's been known to remind attorneys, particularly those from out of state, that there is a specific way of conducting legal proceedings in Massachusetts. During one tense exchange with a defense lawyer attempting to argue with her while seated, she firmly stated, "In Massachusetts, we stand." This illustrates a no-nonsense approach. She had also had to mediate heated disagreements between attorneys, at one point instructing both sides to take the personal attacks completely out of this. When tensions continued to escalate, in a moment that went viral online, she directly advised Karen Reed after observing what she perceived as laughter during a serious point in the proceedings. "Is this funny to you, Miss Reed?" she asked, her voice carrying throughout the courtroom. "Is this not difficult for you?" It's not difficult to understand why Judge Cannone has become a center point of frustration for many. She has issued a series of rulings that have significantly limited the defense's ability to present their case, including restrictions on who they can bring into court, what their experts can testify about, and how their supporters can demonstrate their support. Whether these rulings are legally sound is a question we will continue to explore. But their profound impact on the second Karen Reed trial is undeniable. In making these decisions, Judge Beverly Cannone has become one of the most intensely scrutinized figures in the entire case. There's a common saying that judges speak through their rulings, but in the Karen Reed case, Judge Beverly Cannone's words from the bench have resonated far beyond the courtroom walls, amplified by cell phone cameras, hashtags, live streams. In most criminal trials, a judge remains a relatively background figure, managing schedules, ruling on objections, and observing the legal boundaries and overseeing them. However, in this instance, Judge Cannone has transformed into something more, a symbol, a target, a referee, a character, and a narrative that's being actively written and rewritten by the court of public opinion this whole time. And at the heart of this swirling storm is a man named Aidan Kearney, better known as Turtle Boy. If you haven't encountered Turtle Boy before, you likely haven't delved into the expansive ecosystem, digital ecosystem, that has sprung up around the Karen Reed case. However, if you're following the details closely, Kearney is an unavoidable presence. He's a blogger, a live streamer, and a self-proclaimed investigative journalist, even calling himself Journalism Jesus. No overstating anything there, who has relentlessly championed the cause of Karen Reed. From the earliest stages of the investigation, he's been promoting an alternative narrative that Karen Reed is innocent and that the true circumstances surrounding John O'Keefe's death are being actively controlled by local law enforcement, politicians, and now, in his view, the courts. Judge Cannone has become a reoccurring figure in Kearney's blog posts and live streams, invariably portrayed as an unfavorable human being. In his interpretation, Judge Cannone is not a neutral arbiter attempting to manage a complex case. Instead, she is depicted as a willing participant in a corrupt system. When she denied the defense's request to name Colin Elbert as an alternative suspect, he was among the first to voice strong disapproval. He labeled the ruling as outrageous, accusing Judge Cannone of protecting insiders, and characterized her courtroom as a place where the truth was not only ignored, but actively suppressed. This type of rhetoric established the tone for a subsequent wave of digital outrage. The repercussions were immediate. Across Reddit threads, Telegram channels, and Facebook groups boasting tens of thousands of members, Judge Cannone's rulings were meticulously dissected, reposted, and reinterpreted. Some users created memes comparing her to villainous characters from popular culture. Others delved into her professional history, searching for connections, whether real or imagined, to the individuals whom Karen Reed's defense believed were inside the house on the night of O'Keefe's death. The underlying logic often followed this pattern. If Judge Cannone ruled against the defense, it must be because she is protecting someone rather than because the legal standards were not met or the evidence was insufficient. It must be. If they're telling us we're wrong, it's got to be something else. That's not a healthy way of thinking. That's not a normal way of thinking. You can be wrong. We all can be wrong. There are rules and decorum to courts. And if a judge says, as they would in any case, if your witness, if your attorney that you're trying to bring on doesn't really need to be there or doesn't fit the standards of what you're trying to claim somebody has done, then yeah, they can't be brought in. You can't just make up stories and tell a jury that it's true if there's little to no evidence to back up your story. It did not take long for this suspicion to solidify into certainty, at least within the echo chambers of the online discussions. One of the most frequently repeated claims online has been the so-called anti-Bev theory. This originated from a screenshot of a Facebook comment where an individual allegedly connected to one of the Alberts referenced to Judge Cannoni as anti-Bev. This single line spawned an elaborate conspiracy theory suggesting that Judge Cannoni had a personal relationship with the family being discussed by the defense, the fact that there was no verifiable connection, and that the name Cannoni was even misspelled in the payment memo cited by the defense seemed to matter little. You know, facts don't matter if they don't go along with your narrative. It's true, and it's a very true characteristic of narcissism. Once it circulated on social media, it became accepted truth for a segment of already predisposed individuals to view her as compromised. And when Judge Cannoni declined to recuse herself, explaining in a detailed order that these rumors were unsubstantiated and did not constitute grounds for removal, it only served to further inflame the situation. To her critics, the fact that no appellate court had intervened or that the motion lacked concrete evidence, you know, what you kind of need, of bias, they were irrelevant to them. What mattered was the perception that the judge was, in their view, choosing to remain on a case where the defense had raised significant concern. For many within the Karen Reed camp, this alone was enough to label her as an adversary. But no matter how many pots you bang on, drums you hit, bells you ring, screams you make, it doesn't remove a judge unless there is a true reason to remove a judge. And even in many cases when there is a true reason to remove a judge, it's not very easy. It wasn't solely the rulings that drew criticism. It was also Judge Cannoni's handling of the courtroom proceedings, clips of her stern tone, her insistence that lawyers stand when addressing the court, you know, decorum, and her sharp reprimand to Karen Reed for smiling during a hearing became prime material for online commentary. These instances were interpreted not as a judge maintaining order, but as a display of power, or worse, as evidence that she had already made up her mind. The good thing is the judge doesn't decide the case, that's the jury. The underlying message conveyed in these videos was often far from subtle. From what was perceived as her harshness towards the defense, she was labeled as cold, smug, and even sadistic in certain online circles. The language was repeated, shared, and amplified into more dramatic assertions that she hates Karen, that she is covering for murderers, and that she is unfit to serve on the bench. As the public narrative intensified, so did the real-world consequences. The protest movement that had formed outside the Norfolk Superior Courthouse began to evolve. It was no longer solely about supporting Karen Reed. It also became about confronting what many perceived as institutional corruption. Signs bearing Judge Cannoni's name began to appear. Protesters chanted slogans not only demanding justice for Karen, but also calling for the judge's removal. And when Judge Cannoni issued her buffer zone order, extending the no protest area around the courthouse to 200 feet, it triggered a wave of backlash. Four Massachusetts residents, including at least two who had been regular participants in the protest, filed a federal lawsuit accusing Judge Cannoni of violating their First Amendment rights. They argued that she was using the power of the court to suppress political speech, not to protect the integrity of the trial. Their legal argument highlighted that the order prohibited all demonstrations within the designated area, regardless of topic or tone. It didn't just apply to the Free Karen Reed signs. It encompassed labor strikes, environmental protests, to any form of public expression. To her critics, this was clear evidence that Judge Cannoni had overstepped her authority. The lawsuit described the buffer zone as vague, excessively broad, and potentially dangerous. One plaintiff even referred to it as a lawless act. They likely have not watched other trials. Civil liberties attorneys, including some associated and affiliated with First Amendment advocacy groups, began to offer their perspectives. Even the ACLU of Massachusetts filed an amicus brief in support of the protesters' right to assemble peacefully. And you can do that. There's nothing wrong with saying, I don't agree. Yet Judge Cannoni remained steadfast in her position, which she has the right to do. She cited concerns about juror safety, the necessity of ensuring a fair trial, and previous instances where chanting had reportedly been audible inside the courthouse. And in her view, the order was essential for safeguarding the sanctity of the judicial process. However, to her opponents, it represented yet another instance of a judge attempting to shield herself from public scrutiny and accountability. This fundamental divide between legal reasoning and public reaction has created a peculiar feedback loop within the courtroom. Judge Cannoni continues to issue orders that generally fall within the scope of judicial discretion. Outside the courtroom, these same orders are interpreted as part of a larger pattern of obstruction and bias. And no individual has been more instrumental in fueling those perceptions than the blogger. His posts frequently appear under the constant heading of a Canton cover-up, part, insert number here. In each installment, he meticulously dissects the latest developments in the case, although switching the lens between suspicion and accusation. When the buffer zone was announced, he accused a judge of attempting to own the streets of Dedham. He questioned her legal authority to restrict protests in public spaces, criticized the ambiguous language of the order, and speculated about her underlying motives, suggesting that it was intended to silence opposition rather than protect the jury. These posts were widely disseminated as and treated as credible sources of information by many within the Karen Reed supporter base. They're not perceived as mere opinions or theories, but accepted as factual documents. This is where the court of public opinion diverges most dramatically from the actual courtroom. Inside the building, evidence must meet specific legal thresholds to be considered admissible. That's how it works. So we don't try people on the streets with angry mobs. Outside, it simply needs to go viral to gain traction as being acceptable. What's particularly striking is the limited weight given among some of these supporters to the fact that no appellate court has found any evidence of misconduct on Judge Cannoni's part. There have been no reprimands, no reversals of her rulings, and no orders for her to step aside from the case. This reality receives little attention online because it does not align with the prevailing narrative. The judge is often presumed guilty of a bias simply because she does not consistently rule in favor of the defendant's motions. When she does rule in favor of the defense, such as when she denied some of the prosecution's more aggressive subpoena requests, it's often barely mentioned, as it does not fit the established storyline. Even mainstream news outlets have encountered challenges in covering this case without inadvertently becoming part of the unfolding drama. Traditional reporting has largely focused on presenting factual accounts, summarizing Judge Cannoni's orders, and providing both sides with an opportunity to respond. However, this type of balanced reporting is often quickly overshadowed when a blogger with a substantial online following goes live and declares, often in capital letters, "Cannoni is shielding murderers." Big old blank statements like bumper stickers, because they always mean so much. In the online sphere of this case, the loudest and most sensational voice tends to capture the most attention. This dynamic is not entirely new. We've witnessed similar phenomena in other high-profile trials. Judges are sometimes compelled to make unpopular decisions, particularly when applying legal rules that do not always align with public sentiment or one side. However, in this instance, the backlash has taken on a life of its own. It transcends mere disagreement and extends to a delegitimization of the judge herself. Every ruling is incorporated into a broader conspiracy theory, and every procedural decision is twisted into evidence of collusion. It's where the situation begins to become particularly complex. If the public no longer perceives the judge as a neutral arbiter, if they believe she is complicit in the alleged crime rather than simply managing the trial, then the very foundation of the legal process begins to erode. This raises significant questions about the interplay between public perception and legal reality. Can a trial truly be considered fair when a substantial portion of the public is convinced, even before any testimony is presented, that the presiding judge is corrupt? We've been following the Karen Reed trial through social media. It's likely feeling as though Judge Beverly Cano has already been tried and convicted in the court of public opinion, depending on whom you ask. She's either the courageous and responsible figure attempting to navigate a chaotic scene through a media circus, or she's the ultimate antagonist in a system-wide conspiracy determined to suppress the truth. But let us take a step back for a moment. Let's strip away the hashtags, the protest chants, the live stream rants, and the conspiracy theories circulating online. What are we left with? We are left with a judge performing the duties of her office, making decisions based on established legal rules, precedents, and procedures. That's what we have. Those decisions pose a question that much of the internet has overlooked entirely. Are these rulings actually unjust? Or are they just unpopular? That's a question you need to ask yourself when we're examining this case, because depending on what side you're on, or more importantly, maybe don't be on a side, that can certainly influence what you think or feel about this case. The third party culprit argument is a big one. The defense sought to argue that other individuals, specifically Colin Elbert, were responsible for the death of John O'Keefe. They'd previously introduced this theory during the first trial, referencing an alleged altercation within the Elbert home and suggesting that O'Keefe's body was subsequently left outside. However, as the retrial is approached, Judge Cannone ruled against allowing the defense to name Colin Elbert as an alternate suspect. Here, it's important to understand the relevant legal standards. Massachusetts law does not permit the introduction of unsubstantiated accusations in the hope that something might prove relevant. To name a third-party culprit in a murder case, the defense must demonstrate several key elements: motive, opportunity, and a direct connection to the crime. Simply stating, "Well, he was present, and we suspect he might have done it," it's not a legal argument. It's insufficient. The courts require a legitimate evidentiary basis. This is akin to applying for a loan. A compelling narrative alone is not enough. Supporting documentation is necessary. Judge Cannone's ruling was grounded in this very principle. She reviewed the evidence presented by the defense regarding Colin Elbert and concluded that nothing had changed since the first trial. There were no new witnesses, no additional physical evidence, and no new information that meaningfully and verifiably connected Colin Elbert to the crime scene. Consequently, she determined that the threshold for naming him as a third-party suspect or culprit had not been met. Legally, this is a standard application of the rules of evidence. Individuals cannot be named as murderers without a solid foundation of proof. This rule serves to protect both the accused and the innocent bystanders from being unfairly implicated in legal proceedings without cause. Of course, for Karen Reed supporters, this ruling was not perceived this way. They, of course, viewed it as an attempt by the judge to suppress the truth. However, From a legal perspective, Judge Cannone was performing a crucial gatekeeping function that every trial judge is expected to exercise. Without such a filter, trials could easily divulge into chaotic spectacles like this. With every local rumor being potential line of questioning, it would not serve the interests of justice. It would create chaos. The same principles of gatekeeping apply to the issue of expert testimony, specifically the defense's intention to call Michael Easter, the former FBI agent. The defense wished for Easter to testify that the police investigation into O'Keefe's death was substandard, potentially even corrupt. He was prepared to tell the jury that, in his professional opinion, the police had failed to follow proper protocol. While this might sound dramatic, Judge Cannone again ruled against it. The rationale behind this decision is that judges generally discourage experts from instructing juries on how to interpret behavior, particularly when that behavior is something the jury can observe and evaluate for themselves. The jury hears directly from the officers who process the scene, reviews the reports, and observes their testimony and cross-examination. Believe me, they'll be capable in this case of forming their own judgments about the quality of the investigation, and it's not going to be a good one. They don't need a required law enforcement critic-in-chief to stand before them and point fingers. That sort of testimony carries a risk of undermining the jury's role as the ultimate fact-finder, something judges strive to avoid. Judge Cannone's ruling was not an abnormality here. It aligns with well-established rules of evidence in courtrooms across the country. Experts are permitted to discuss methodologies, evidence, collection techniques, and forensic procedures, but they are typically barred from directly accusing law enforcement officers of incompetence or dishonesty. Luckily, in this case, it just kind of reveals itself. The type of testimony is considered argument. And the presentation of arguments is the role of the lawyers, not the expert witness. Therefore, Judge Cannone was again enforcing a standard designed to prevent trials from becoming a competition of who can present the most sensational witness with the most accusatory presentation. And the situation involving Mark Bedrow, that matter delves into legal ethics. But it is a crucial thing to understand. The judge's decision. Bedrow, a defense attorney from New York, sought to join Karen Reed's legal team just weeks before the commencement of the trial. However, he also represented Turtle Boy in several pending criminal cases directly related to Reed's case. Presents a significant and obvious conflict of interest. It does. Ethical rules governing legal profession prohibit lawyers from representing clients whose interests might conflict. Which does here, especially in the same or closely related matter. It's because a lawyer might gain confidential information from one client that could be used to the detriment or the benefit of the other. In this instance, Bedrow even acknowledged that he had privileged communications with the blogger that he would not use in his defensive read. The statement essentially is admission of a conflict. And consider a sports analogy. A coach who possesses both teams' playbook but promises not to use that knowledge unfairly would not be permitted by any sort of professional league to be the coach. Similarly, such a situation should not be allowed in a courtroom. Judge Cannone denied Bedrow's request to join the defense team, and this decision is consistent with standard legal practice. Like it or not, it is. She did not question Bedrow's competence as an attorney or the defense's right to choose their counsel. Instead, she determined that this argument created an insurmountable conflict of interest and that the ethical rules simply do not permit that. She pointed out that Reed already had a team of capable attorneys, including three who had already been admitted pro hoc vice. And that adding Bedrow could potentially jeopardize the entire trial if ethical issues were to arise later. Yeah, it really could. It could lead to a lot of appellate issues as well. It wasn't an act of obstruction, but rather a display of necessary caution, the type of caution that judges are expected to exercise when integrity of a trial is at stake. Judge Cannone is trying to just enforce the rules. At least that's what one side feels. The other still very, very divided and feeling that it's something much darker, much more involved. Tell me what you think in the comments section on our YouTube page. If you're on the podcast platform, if you can comment there. If not, hop over to our YouTube channel. Check it out. You can watch us do these reports. And you can get involved in the conversation as well. Just search the Hidden Killers podcast on YouTube, wherever, or on YouTube. I was going to say wherever you get YouTube. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And be sure to press subscribe. We love to hear your opinions. We love your support. So thank you so much for that. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us as we continue to break down and cover the trial part two of Miss Karen Reed.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. She was the perfect wife. Always smiling, always supportive. A pillar of the community. Beloved by friends, adored by family. And secretly researching undetectable poisons in her spare time. Maybe it was the way he chewed. Maybe she just got bored. Or maybe, just maybe, she had been planning this since the honeymoon. But if he had just paid attention, if he had just known what to look for, if he had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and learned the red flags, he could have heard every episode of Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Ad-free, and before everyone else, he could have seen it coming. Instead, he's 6 feet under, and she's shopping for husband number two. Don't be like him. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.